Hi, it's Connor Hall, producer for Wrongful Conviction. If you're looking for another gripping investigative series, check out the brand new podcast Spotlight Snitch City. Produced by the Boston Globe's award-winning Spotlight team, Snitch City brings you inside the secret world of police informants through one small city at the forefront of America's drug war, New Bedford, Massachusetts. Over the last two decades, the 250-member New Bedford Police Department has been a poster child for informant misconduct, lies, deception, cover-ups of cover-ups. And in the last few years alone, officers have fabricated tips, carried on sexual relationships with informants, and even coaxed them to lie in court. Featuring never-before-told cases, Snitch City investigates how officers have exploited the secrecy of the informant system to enrich themselves, break laws, protect drug dealers, and attack perceived enemies, all with impunity. Tune in before the whistle is blown. Follow Spotlight Snitch City on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
This is Mel Reid, LPGA Tour winner and six-time Ladies European Tour winner.
And Kira K. Dixon, NBC Sports reporter and host.
And we've got a new podcast, Quiet Please, with Mel.
And Kira, we are bringing you spicy takes on sports and pop culture, some interviews with incredible people who have figured out how to make golf their superpower.
An iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment. You can find us on iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by Elf Beauty, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports.
I'm Tomer Cohen, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. If you're just as curious as I am about the way things are built, then tune in to my podcast, Building One. I speak with some of the best product builders out there.
I've always been inspired by frustration.
It came back to my own personal pain point.
So we had to go out to farmers and convince them.
Following that curiosity is a superpower.
You have to be obsessed with the human condition.
Listen to Building One on the iHeartRadio app, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On July 21st, 1997, a young man was fatally shot while being driven past a building in Brooklyn, New York. The driver, Carlos Bethune, told police that he hadn't seen the shooter, but later named a resident of that building, Jermaine Archer, who ran for his life from Bethune, the victim's family, and the police. In retaliation, Jermaine's brother was shot, but survived. Soon, tensions cooled when the families figured out who the actual shooter was, but the police stayed stuck on Jermaine, and Carlos Bethune went along for the ride. This is Wrongful Conviction.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's episode, well, let's just say it features a man named Jermaine Archer, who I consider a friend and a personal hero. And I'm so glad to welcome you to the show, Jermaine, because this is a story people need to hear. So first of all, I'm glad you're here. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for inviting me to the show. And I want to shout out my attorney, Peter Cross, who's here with me, who's been with me through the fire. When a bunch of other people walked away, attorneys included, Peter didn't go nowhere. Peter stood here, worked with me pro bono. He believed in me. He believed in my innocence. And eventually, he helped me prove it.
Well, I was about to introduce Peter, but you did a much better job than I could have possibly done. So thank you for that. And Peter, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, my pleasure.
Let's go back in time. Jermaine, you grew up in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn, New York. Marcy Projects, and then eventually Flatbush. Looking back, my childhood was great. I mean, we weren't rich by any means. I'm the seventh of 11 or 12, whoever you want to believe. My father says 11. My mother says 12. She said my father went and had another child that we don't know about, but we were kind of separated through the years. I grew up with five boys and one girl living in my apartment, and I just always felt protected. Like, I'm the seventh, the baby in the family on that side. And my mother went to work at 5 a.m. She didn't come home till sometime 9 o'clock at night. But we had everything we needed. I might have didn't have the latest, most expensive sneakers that I might have wanted, but it was nothing but love growing up in Brooklyn.
And you were growing up in the 90s, which was a crazy time, rife with street crime and police violence and corruption. And those go together sometimes, unfortunately. And of course, the news media, any crime that happened, they would amplify it. There's a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. And then that would, of course, drive the pressure on the police to make arrests and for ultimately people to get convicted.
I would say because of the Giuliani, Pataki, tough on crime era, I know personally 15 people that were wrongly convicted. It was 5 district attorneys across New York City that were just prosecuting people. It didn't matter if they got the right person for the crime. They were holding witnesses hostage. They were holding witnesses in hotels. They were paying witnesses and lying about it. They were using drug addicts to testify.
And when you lock up the wrong person, the right person remains free and everybody's in danger.
And it wasn't about making the streets safer. It was about incarcerating as many black and brown bodies as they could from poor communities. Who was going to really complain?
And when this crime took place, it was the time of, for people who can remember this far back, it was the same summer as Abner Louima.
First off, Abner Louima was violated by the same precinct that investigated and eventually charged me in this case, 7-0 precinct.
So for those who don't recall, Abner Louima was scooped up from the scene of a fight and was brought back to the 70th precinct, where he was not only brutally beaten by the police, but was also, and brace yourself, I'm sorry I have to even say this, but he was sexually assaulted with a broomstick. Thankfully, those officers were charged and convicted, but this was the precinct where just a few weeks before, in late July, there was some friction between two groups, Jermaine's family and friends at 20 Westminster Road and the victim, Patrick Niles, his people, specifically his older brother, Ronaldo, and a guy named Carlos Bethune.
Carlos Bethune was Ronaldo's right-hand man. That was his friend. I only knew him as the short, chubby guy that's always with Ronaldo. I didn't even know his name until this case actually happened. I didn't know Ronaldo's name. We called him Crocodile because he got a long face.
Crocodillo.
It's Crocodile in Spanish, but Cocodrilo. And that's his nickname. We didn't give him that name. He was known for violence. He was a street guy. I can't really say that I've witnessed him do certain things that other people said he did, but I know he was one not to be played with. I know that. Looking back, I understand that they was just troubled young people like me that was involved in some things we probably had no business being involved in.
And that sets the stage for July 20th, 1997.
July 20th, 1997. I was walking down the street with a friend of mine. We wanted to go to the store, and there was a girl sitting on a bike, and she was talking to a couple of people from the neighborhood that we knew. I asked her if I could borrow her bike. She looked hesitant. I was like, I'm going to give you back your bike. And my friend offered her some money to hold. It was like a lot of money. So the guy she was talking to, Ronaldo, showed up, and he snatched the bike and said, yo, don't ever disrespect me again. And I was like, we cool. Like, where is this coming from? He had just given me a ride the other day to my sister's house. So we grew up together. I didn't know. I found out later that his father died that night. That's where the attitude was coming from. But I didn't know. I was like, no problem. It ain't even worth it. I went back in front of my building. I told my brother, Michael, what happened because they were the same age. And he said, just stay in front of the building. I'll talk to him in the morning. I don't know. Maybe he's going through something. A little while later, as I'm walking to the store, he pulled up in the car and pulled out a gun. The people that I was with ran except one. He said, yo, I know you went and got a gun. Don't make me leave you one brother's less. All this craziness. And then he leaves again. I go back and tell my brother again. And my brother tells me, stay upstairs for the night. The next day, I'm in the house the entire day with my children's mother. I don't want to go outside. I want my brother to be able to talk to him. I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know if he's going to send anybody. He's notorious. People knows who he is.
So the kids who hung out in front of Jermaine's building, 20 Westminster Road, they were aware of the danger from Ronaldo and his crew while doing what they normally did. And the police, well, they were doing what they normally did.
Normally, we're on the corner shooting dice, smoking weed, drinking beer, talking to girls. It was literally like that was the hangout. But that night, I stood in front of the building. This is those days of tough on crime. The police came. They did this almost every night. They would search us literally 2 or 3 times a night. So they came, they put us on a wall, even in front of my building. They patted everybody down that was there, and they drove off. When they drove off, I got up. I went to the alley to piss. While I was in the alley, I was talking to 3 girls in the window. And I'm joking with them, like, this is kind of heavy. Could y'all hold this for me? Wash your hands. I'm having fun with these girls, the things we do in the neighborhood. And while we're all talking, one of them stuck her head back in the window. The other two stood. While we were talking, we heard 3 shots. So they literally had eyes on me when the shots were fired. After that, I'm trying to get my stuff together because I don't know what's going on. I'm thinking it's Ronaldo. He's back. He's shooting at us.
But it wasn't Ronaldo out in front of the building. Carlos Bethune had driven by and someone shot into the car, killing Ronaldo's brother, Patrick Niles.
I go up to my roof. My best friend comes up to the roof and I'm like, why? And he's like, what are you asking me for? I don't know. And so I'm thinking it's going to be a problem because they're notorious. They got guns. They gangsters. Why would this guy do this in front of me? Like, I'm upset at the time. I don't know what's going on.
Now the police came to investigate. And luckily, a neighbor kid named Kester Jones saw the whole thing and was interviewed. However, it doesn't seem to have been memorialized.
Kester thinks he was interviewed. I don't know if it was, in fact, by the police. He had been playing basketball at the park down the street. His apartment was all the way at the end of the block. And so as he was walking home, he happened to be there when this happened. He saw the guys outside Jermaine's apartment building, and he didn't want to walk by there because, you know, he didn't want to get harassed. So he was trying to get over to the other side of the street, and that's how he was right there behind it when he saw exactly what happened.
He said he saw a car stop near the first building, which was 10. Then he saw another car stop by 20, which was my building. And then he saw someone run into the street and shoot at the car from behind as he was driving down the block. It went through the back passenger window. It struck a victim behind his right ear and went from right to left, according to the medical examiner. So Carlos Bethune went to the precinct that night and he said, I don't know what happened. I was driving down the block. I heard three shots. I took off. My friend got shot in the head. That must have been true. 3 days later, he went back to the precinct and said, I lied to y'all. Jermaine did it. Bang did it. They call me Bang. Bang did it. Now, the story he gave couldn't have been true because, one, he's the driver of the car. So the only way you can see somebody shoot your friend in the back of the head is if you're driving looking backwards. But he said Bang came and jumped in front of the car stopped, ran to the side, and shot the passenger in the head. The medical examiner proved that couldn't have happened that way because there was no stippling. There was no gunpowder residue on the person's head. The crime scene investigator said it couldn't happen that way because the bullet didn't come through the passenger window. It came through the back window. So none of the stuff he said lined up, but he said, I did it. We found out later, Ronaldo convinced Carlos to implicate me so that they could track me down.
So Ronaldo believed Jermaine had done it, even though the folks at 20 Westminster knew otherwise. And now, as the result, Jermaine was in real danger.
So I'm not trying to get shot for something I didn't do, and I'm not trying to get arrested for something I didn't do. So I ended up leaving. I went to New Jersey. I came back upstate, and I went to Pennsylvania. And eventually, I just dropped off my children's mother and my children, and then I just was like living on the road. I had a car. I was just driving back and forth from state to state. I wasn't staying in any place too long because I figured over time, the police would realize I didn't do it, and I'll be able to figure out what comes next.
So while Jermaine was out of town, Ronaldo tried something else to try to smoke him out.
About 3 weeks after that, I'm not sure the exact date, but it was August 1997. My brother was at his house in Queens, and Ronaldo pulled up. We're still unsure how he found out where he lived, but Ronaldo pulled up on him. He was with his daughter, and he just shot him up.
And Carlos Bethune was allegedly the driver. Now, miraculously, Jermaine's brother lived. And now this attempted murder with a surviving witness was looming over them. Meanwhile, about 7 months rolled by before the police caught up with Jermaine in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where he was arrested and sent back to New York.
When they arrested me, they said, you're going to tell us who did it or we're going to lock you up. And I was like, I didn't see the crime. I'm being honest. Like I said, I was in the alley. So that was part of the problem. I didn't see the crime. Well, who did it? And I said, you can't put this on me. I remember telling the officer that. And he said, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to lock you up. You're going to go in the lineup and you're going to get picked out. And then you'll take your chances at trial. Or you can just tell me who did it right now. And I remember saying something slick like, the jacket don't fit. Because everyone knew me. I was a petty drug dealer at the time. The jacket don't fit. And as if we had both seen the same movie, he spit right back. I know a good tailor.
Hi, it's Connor Hall, producer for Wrongful Conviction. If you're looking for another gripping investigative series, check out the brand new podcast Spotlight Snitch City. Produced by the Boston Globe's award-winning Spotlight team, Snitch City brings you inside the secret world of police informants through one small city at the forefront of America's drug war, New Bedford, Massachusetts. Over the last two decades, the 250-member New Bedford Police Department has been a poster child for informant misconduct, lies, deception, cover-ups, of cover-ups. And in the last few years alone, officers have fabricated tips, carried on sexual relationships with informants, and even coaxed them to lie in court. Featuring never-before-told cases, Snitch City investigates how officers have exploited the secrecy of the informant system to enrich themselves, break laws, protect drug dealers, and attack perceived enemies, all with impunity. Tune in before the whistle is blown. Follow Spotlight Snitch City on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
Sonoro and iHeart's My Cultura Podcast Network present The Setup, a new romantic comedy podcast starring Harvey Guillen and Christian Navarro. The Setup follows a lonely museum curator searching for love. But when the perfect man walks into his life...
Well, I guess I'm saying I like you. You like me?
He actually is too good to be true.
This is a con. I'm conning you. To get the Delano painting, we could do this together.
To pull off this heist, they'll have to get close and jump into the deep end together.
That's a huge leap, Fernando, don't you think?
After you, Chulito.
But love is the biggest risk they'll ever take.
Fernando's never going to love you as much as he loves this job.
Chulito, that painting is ours.
Listen to The Setup as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to introduce a brand new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. I'm having conversations with some interesting folks across a wide range of industries to hear how they reach the top of their fields and the lessons they learned along the way that everyone can use. I'll be joined by innovative leaders like Chairman and CEO of Elf Beauty, Tarang Amin.
The way I approach risk is constantly try things and actually make it okay to fail.
I'm sitting down with legendary singer-songwriter and philanthropist, Jewel.
I wanted a way to do something that I loved for the rest of my life.
We're also hearing how leaders brought their businesses out of unprecedented times, like Stefan Bancel, CEO of Moderna.
It becomes a human decision to decide to throw by the window your business strategy and to do what you think is the right thing for the world.
Join me as we uncover innovations in data and analytics, the math, and the ever-important creative spark, the magic. Listen to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
So when Carlos implicated me and the police arrested me, he came to the lineup and said, I'm not really sure. And then he made a phone call. And somebody on the phone call, according to the detective, was trying to convince him not to identify me. My belief was that they wanted to get me back in New York and then let me walk out of the precinct where they knew I would be unarmed and gun me down. That's what I'm thinking. Like, you're coming out the precinct, you definitely can't defend yourself, and they'll gun me down there. But they didn't realize I had a probation violation.
Which sent him to Rikers Island, while the police arrested his child's mother's brother.
They got him for some drugs, and they said, we don't even want you. You just got to say what we need you to say for bang. And he said that he didn't see who shot, but that I went to his house, and he had a bunch of guns in his house, and I put a bunch of guns in a book bag and came downstairs and started handing them out, which was a cold-blooded lie.
And so he was indicted, but Carlos Bethune had still not identified him.
When they didn't identify me in a lineup, I was thinking either they're going to try to work this out, or they're going to try to exact street revenge. Ronaldo ended up tracking down my brother, saying, I thought he shot my brother, my bad. So I knew by then they knew I didn't do it. So I wasn't really concerned with going to trial because I didn't think they was going to testify against me. And I found out later that the district attorney and the police pressured Carlos. It reached a certain point where he was also hiding from Ronaldo. That's in those transcripts too. He was hiding from Ronaldo because he said, according to him, he thought Ronaldo wanted to kill him.
It appears Carlos was willing to cooperate, which conflicted with Ronaldo's plan to avoid his own charges, seeking Michael's forgiveness for the attempted murder by not helping the prosecutors close his brother's murder case with Jermaine, who it appears they knew was the wrong person. And Jermaine's attorney, Jesse Young, was trying to expose whether or not Carlos had accepted a deal.
There was back and forth whether they let Carlos off the hook in my brother's shooting. He brought his paperwork to the court and the judge went through his file and they said they couldn't find anything. We knew there was a deal made. We just wasn't sure where the deal was made. We thought it was in Queens, but it wasn't. It was actually in Kings County.
Jermaine's attorney tried to admit Michael Archer as a witness, as to why Carlos might have had a reason to testify.
They wouldn't let my brother testify because he was not a witness to the crime that I was being charged with. What happened on July 21st, 1997, in front of 20 Westminster Road? If you have nothing to say about that, we're not going to let you come in and testify. So they took me to trial. Carlos said what he said.
Carlos testified about the confrontations in the lead up to the shooting and then his alleged experience that night, stopping his car near 20 Westminster Road to let a disabled person across the street. Well, such an upstanding guy, right? And then Jermaine allegedly emerged from a minivan, firing into the vehicle. Carlos was cross-examined with how that differed from his original statement and how he'd said that he hadn't seen the shooter.
I had no concerns whatsoever. Like, there's no way they're going to convict me on this because I didn't do it. And also because he done flipped the story a couple of times. And because there's people that saw it that's willing to come and testify. My children's mother, her sister, and my best friend all came and said it wasn't Bang. Bang was in an alley when the shots fired. My children's mother was on the street, so she seen it. They all testified that it wasn't me.
And they even named the person who they'd all seen shoot Patrick Niles. However, being Jermaine's friends and family appears to have hurt their credibility. But what about the other guy, Kester Jones?
Kester wanted to testify. He was in court. To this day, I have no idea why he didn't testify. I know Kester, even recently, he brought it up. He said he went to court ready to testify. And someone came and told him, we don't need you.
But they needed everything they had because Carlos Bethune and the prosecutor's strategy appear to have been enough for the jury.
It's off the record, but one of the jurors reached out to my brother after the trial. Not sure how she found him and said it couldn't get over the nickname Bang.
Yeah. Not helpful.
Wasn't helpful, but my mother named me after Bang Bang Morales. It was a boxer in the 70s. So she nicknamed me after him. But the prosecutor, if you go through the transcripts, she doesn't call me Archer. She doesn't call me Jermaine. And Bang did this and Bang did that. And she was emphasizing it. Most people curse their lawyer out when they get convicted. And I remember just telling him, thank you, man. You tried. And I remember my mother telling me that she was hysterical and crying and everything. But the judge, Michael Juvel, actually saw her in the hallway and said, your son should have took a bench trial. Basically, if I'd have took a bench trial, I would have beat the case at trial.
Immediately following the verdict, Jermaine's attorney filed a motion to vacate and set aside the verdict, questioning whether the preclusion of Michael Archer had denied Jermaine a fair trial. Additionally, Jermaine's brothers had secretly recorded alleged confessions from the actual shooter. They had a hearing, but the recordings were difficult to hear. Meanwhile, Ronaldo was trying to avoid his own trial.
After I got convicted, he sent word through a family friend. He said, let's do what we can to make it right. If you don't press charges against me, I'll make this guy recant the story against your brother. And then Ronaldo convinced Carlos to recant his testimony, which was the second time he changed the story. He turned around and said, I'm not sure it was him. They saying it was this guy. I heard they look alike. I don't want to send an innocent man to prison. So then he changed the story. And then they overturned the conviction.
At this point, Jermaine was released pending a new trial.
And then I don't know the specifics of that deal. I'm not going to give hearsay. I just know that deal fell apart. And 3-4 months after that, he changed the story again. It was like, you know what? On second thought, it wasn't. I heard the judge tell Peggy, and this is Assistant District Attorney Peggy Hoffman, you're overtrying this case. He's clearly not an angel, but it doesn't look like he did this. The judge told her that. It was in an off-the-record, you know, sidebar. But I heard her. And she said, I'm just following instructions from up top, Your Honor. So basically, Charles Hines or whoever he delegated, they were saying, we're going to fight this case all the way through. And they put me back in prison behind that.
Hi, it's Connor Hall, producer for Wrongful Conviction. If you're looking for another gripping investigative series, check out the brand new podcast Spotlight Snitch City. Produced by the Boston Globe's award-winning Spotlight team, Snitch City brings you inside the secret world of police informants through one small city at the forefront of America's drug war, New Bedford, Massachusetts. Over the last two decades, the 250-member New Bedford Police Department has been a poster child for informant misconduct, lies, deception, cover-ups of cover-ups. And in the last few years alone, officers have fabricated tips, carried on sexual relationships with informants, and even coaxed them to lie in court. Featuring never-before-told cases, Snitch City investigates how officers have exploited the secrecy of the informant system to enrich themselves, break laws, protect drug dealers, and attack perceived enemies, all with impunity. Tune in before the whistle is blown. Follow Spotlight Snitch City on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
Sonoro and iHeart's My Cultura Podcast Network present The Setup, a new romantic comedy podcast starring Harvey Guillen and Christian Navarro. The Setup follows a lonely museum curator searching for love. But when the perfect man walks into his life...
Well, I guess I'm saying I like you.
You like me?
He actually is too good to be true.
This is a con. I'm conning you. To get the Delano painting, we could do this together.
To pull off this heist, they'll have to get close and jump into the deep end together.
That's a huge leap, Fernando, don't you think?
After you, Chulito.
But love is the biggest risk they'll ever take.
Fernando's never going to love you as much as he loves this job.
Chulito, that painting is ours.
Listen to The Setup as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to introduce a brand new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. I'm having conversations with some interesting folks across a wide range of industries to hear how they reach the top of their fields and the lessons they learned along the way that everyone can use. I'll be joined by innovative leaders like Chairman and CEO of Elf Beauty, Tarang Amin.
The way I approach risk is constantly try things and actually make it okay to fail.
I'm sitting down with legendary singer-songwriter and philanthropist, Jewel.
I wanted a way to do something that I loved for the rest of my life.
We're also hearing how leaders brought their businesses out of unprecedented times, like Stefan Bancel, CEO of Moderna.
It becomes a human decision to decide to throw by the window your business strategy and to do what you think is the right thing for the world.
Join me as we uncover innovations in data and analytics, the math, and the ever-important creative spark, the magic. Listen to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
After I got convicted, you know, my children's mother, she had to move on. I don't have the best relationship with my three biological children because they didn't bring them up to visit me. She had to move on. She got into another relationship, had another child, and she had to focus on that. So I suffered from that. I watched my mother grow old in prison. My health suffered. My mother's health suffered because she knew I didn't do it. Not to say it would have been okay if she knew I did it, but it hurt her more that her baby was in prison for something he didn't do, and she couldn't do anything to help me out, to get me out. So this case just destroyed so many people's lives, not just mine. I realized my time was the same, whether I was in prison or not. It doesn't matter when I hit that grave, that tombstone, that dash, all of this time count. And these 22 years are going to go by, and I'm going to have a 22-year gap in my resume. I'm going to be 22 years older, so I can't do the construction work and all the stuff that I may have been inclined to do. I'm going to be competing with people that never been in prison in the job market, that don't have felonies, and a lot younger and probably better looking than me. So I knew I had to do the best I could while I was in there. I got my paralegal certification. I earned a master's degree. Obviously, bachelor's and associates. I joined Carnegie Hall and learned how to play the piano. I taught classes on HIV and AIDS, on aggression replacement training, on alternatives to violence, on parenting, on healthy relationships. I would have taken classes on marbles if they offered it. It didn't matter. Whatever was there that was therapeutic, educational, academic, I was a part of it, which made my parole packet over 400 pages. But I felt like I'm going to get all of these tools in my tool belt. And when I go home, I'll figure out what I can apply. But I didn't turn down anything.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention reading, writing, and speaking Spanish, French, and German, and creating a Chinese Mandarin language course, the only one ever to be taught inside a New York State prison. And I think the one thing we must talk about is...
Voices from within.
Voices from within. That's what we got to talk about. Yeah.
Absolutely. I was going there next. So it was me and 10 other guys, and... some of us wrongly convicted, some of us not. It doesn't matter. Some of us were out there doing some things. We weren't living the best life. How can we pay our debt to society? How can we make a better community? How can we come together and just be assets, even from the inside? It started out as advocacy, lobbying. We were bringing senators and legislators and judges and community activists into the prison, hosting town halls. And eventually we specialized in preventing youth gun violence because we realized who better to deter them from that behavior than people that was either a victim of it, that were perpetrators of it. So we created workshops. We created a curriculum, choices, choosing healthier options and confronting every situation. And we were doing exercises, playback theater, where a young person would come in and explain how they had got in trouble. And then they get to pick people to reenact that. And they would see it play out in front of their eyes. And then they could see where they could have made a different decision instead of us just saying that was wrong. Maybe you should have did this. And there were other exercises that we did. We were able to get people that's incarcerated to have more time with their non-incarcerated youth in their life. I believe that was one of the most impactful programs that I was a part of. I'm glad to have created it. And I feel like we also created a fraternity through that program. All of us are still close to this day. I think Voices from Within has the power to really change young people's trajectory, because it's not those typical, listen, I did 30 years, let me tell you what it is. It's caring. They don't care how much you know. They want to know how much you care. And we actually show them that we care about you.
Jermaine kept himself very busy in prison, including with a program that was very important to other former guests on Wrongful Conviction podcast. It was actually recently featured, get this, in the Oscar-nominated film Sing Sing. And of course, I'm talking about a theater program called Rehabilitation Through the Arts, or RTA.
I have to say, one, I'm the executive director now, but two, Rehabilitation Through the Arts gave me a childhood that I never had, really. As a teenager, I felt like I was grown. When I got to Rehabilitation Through the Arts, I was able to do goofy things again. I was too cool to do that in high school. I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing no foolishness. But we roll around the floor. We dance. We created safe spaces in there. And the arts heals. So many people went through rehabilitation and either ended up going to college or they ended up creating their own programs. And I have to put that front and center. We created Voices from Within. I was already a member of Rehabilitation Through the Arts. We took some of the exercises to incorporate it, tweaked it to fit our purposes, but a lot of that came from Rehabilitation Through the Arts because people in RTA knew my name. I wasn't a cell number. I wasn't a department identification number. I was Jermaine. Like, it actually restored humanity in so many of us.
In addition to staying busy with programs, Jermaine also continued to fight his case. He was denied on his direct appeal. And then in 2003, he found out about a recording that Ronaldo had made of conversations with Carlos Bethune, which may have been missed by his attorney during his motion to vacate the verdict.
Somehow my mother ran into a private investigator, Kevin Hinkson. He turned over all the files in the case. I didn't realize that there was a recorded transcript between Ronaldo and Carlos Bethune. When I took my time and started going to the law library and reading it, I realized Carlos admitted that they gave him $3,000 to move. That's what he said on the tape. So now I'm trying to figure out, how can I prove this? I don't know a lot about law, but I know that they denied giving him anything. There has to be something illegal or unconstitutional about that. So I filed a Freedom of Information request. They didn't answer it. Eventually, I appealed it. And then they answered it with a certification that says they never gave him anything. There's no records to prove it. They don't have anything in the Kings County District Attorney Office that says they ever had an agreement with him. So, okay, I know it happened. I can't prove it.
And without the proof, he moved forward with post-conviction motions citing ineffective assistance of trial counsel, saying that his attorney should have called Kester Jones and other alibi witnesses. And again, they were denied. Meanwhile, Ken Thompson was elected Brooklyn's district attorney. And before Ken died too young in 2016, he formed a conviction review unit. And at this point, Peter took on Jermaine's case.
So fortunately for us, before Ken Thompson passed away, we had gone pretty far down the road with the reinvestigation of the case by the conviction review unit. The assistant district attorney was a really nice person, very ethical, right? We signed a cooperation agreement where we agreed that we would turn over to them whatever evidence we had, and they agreed they would turn over all the evidence that they had. And in that agreement, they also said they would give us witness statements at some point. But I signed the agreement. My client signed the agreement. We never got a signed copy of the agreement back from them, but they were operating under the agreement.
And Peter asked her, is there anything that shows whatever you may have given benefits to any of the witnesses? We left it broad on purpose. She turned over three sheets of paper that shows, according to that summary, it was $1,300 or something like that. That was the start. I said, Peter, get that. He said, I got it. I said, get anything else you got. So she went back to look for more. They transferred off the case. As soon as they found out she gave us that documentation, she was no longer working the case. She was gone.
The good thing is we discovered that the only alleged eyewitness had a cooperation agreement. He got housing and other compensation from them, his testimony, and they never disclosed that.
In addition to this Brady violation, both the ADA and Carlos Bethune denied the deal existed at trial. And at this point, the conviction review unit went unresponsive. Meanwhile, Jermaine paroled out in 2020.
From prison, I married a beautiful woman and helped raise her children. Their father was murdered. So I got to raise two children from prison. I walked out of prison on November 30th, 2020. My wife, my children, my mother, my brothers, like everyone was waiting on me. There was a film crew waiting on me. I couldn't believe I was out. I wanted to jump in the car and go. I wanted to pinch myself, make sure I wasn't sleeping. They asked me what I wanted to do first. I said McDonald's. And they told me, order whatever I want. And I went up to the register and no one paid me any mind. Of course, I'm not going to make a scene. I was in prison 20 minutes ago, so I'll wait patiently. And eventually, one of the clerks or one of the cashiers told me, you got an order on the kiosk. So I go to this little black-looking thing. I've been in prison 22 years. I don't know how to turn it on. I don't know about touch screen or any of that stuff at the time. My family got a good kick out of that. That was my introduction to technology and how far I had been behind. I didn't even know how to order food at McDonald's on the kiosk. And then they took me home, had a nice little reception of family and friends and supporters. And I got a job at the Legal Aid Society of Westchester 5 weeks later. And Peter and I were discussing, like, when do we file the motion? Because we wanted to wait till I came home. I wanted to be in the courtroom. I didn't want them to deal with a paper motion like all the other ones that had got denied. I wanted them to have to deal with a human being. We waited until September of 2021 to file the motion.
During these proceedings, they tried to compel the DA to share whatever evidence they had that had dried up when the conviction review unit went unresponsive. After all, they had this 2014 cooperation agreement.
When we tried to get them to turn over the witness statements, they said, oh, this is an unsigned agreement. The court, to my chagrin, said, yeah, there's no evidence there was, in fact, this agreement. And obviously there was because we were cooperating under the agreement, both sides.
Because they never provided us with a signed copy of the agreement, like the gamesmanship, like I lost my cool a couple of times and then Peter calmed me down because it was at a point where y'all playing games with my life. And the judge ordered them to turn over whatever else there is in relation to this cooperation agreement. They turned over 8 more pages. So now we have 11 sheets of paper that put the whole thing together. We ended up getting granted a hearing. The official hearing started 2023, lasted about 6 different court dates, and they had given us permission to pursue actual innocence. Under actual innocence, you can bring up things outside of the record. When I got on the stand, the district attorney brought up things that I was accused of. Fifth grade, like it was just chaos. We weren't talking about the murder I was in prison for. We were talking about things that I was never accused of, never convicted of, never charged with. And it was wearing me out. I ended up in the hospital that night. I ended up back on my medication. And after a good, long, lengthy discussion with my attorney, I went back in the courtroom, told the judge, we withdrawing that. We're just going to deal with the Brady violation, which is the fact that you paid someone and you lied about it. They didn't want to talk about the Brady violation. They had 400 pages. And when the judge said, you have to talk about the Brady violation, she said, no further questions, Your Honor, because they couldn't talk about that. They were just going to try to smear me in front of the court. We know when it started. It started the day before trial. And when my lawyer, Jesse Young, intimated that she may have made a deal with him, she said, I just want to point out for the record, no one from my office has promised him anything. They had just promised him that the day before. And we got the paperwork to prove it. And as the hearing went on, it became obvious there was a deal made. You're lying about it. You're still lying about it. And the judge overturned the conviction based on a Brady violation.
And importantly, a material violation. That this would have caused a different verdict at trial. So the conviction was overturned. And we wish you all the luck in the world in civil litigation, as well as at your new job, working for rehabilitation through the arts, this time, though, from outside the walls. And for anyone who wants to get involved or donate, we're going to link to the places you can go in the episode description. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments. First of all, I thank each of you from the bottom of my heart. And now I'm just going to kick back in my chair, close my eyes and leave my headphones on and listen to anything else you guys feel has been left unsaid. So, Peter, you go first and then hand the microphone off to Jermaine, and he'll take us off into the sunset.
Yeah, I think we said it all.
I have a final thought. Anybody that's a resident of Kings County, anybody with connection to the Kings County District Attorney Office, reach out. Prove me wrong. I'm telling everybody I didn't do this crime. Contact the district attorney and ask them, where's the evidence that I did this crime? Contact them and ask them, why are they still wasting taxpayer money on something that is obvious I didn't do? Reach out and find out. If you can find any evidence other than the liar that I did this crime, then hey, now we're talking. But otherwise, this is just political theater. This is just a lot of waste of taxpayer money. People getting paid to uphold something that can't be held up. It's ridiculous. Yes, he's supposed to be a progressive prosecutor. Find out why he has me in the scope and why he won't do the right thing.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good. Hi, it's Connor Hall, producer for Wrongful Conviction. If you're looking for another gripping investigative series, check out the brand new podcast Spotlight Snitch City. Produced by the Boston Globe's award-winning Spotlight team, Snitch City brings you inside the secret world of police informants through one small city at the forefront of America's drug war, New Bedford, Massachusetts. Over the last two decades, the 250-member New Bedford Police Department has been a poster child for informant misconduct, lies, deception, cover-ups of cover-ups. And in the last few years alone, officers have fabricated tips, carried on sexual relationships with informants, and even coaxed them to lie in court. Featuring never-before-told cases, Snitch City investigates how officers have exploited the secrecy of the informant system to enrich themselves, break laws, protect drug dealers, and attack perceived enemies, all with impunity. Tune in before the whistle is blown. Follow Spotlight Snitch City on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now.
This is Mel Reed, LPGA Tour winner and six-time Ladies European Tour winner.
And Kira K. Dixon, NBC Sports reporter and host.
And we've got a new podcast, Quiet Please, with Mel
and Kira. We are bringing you spicy takes on sports and pop culture, some interviews with incredible people who have figured out how to make golf their superpower.
An iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment. You can find us on iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by Elf Beauty, founding partner of iHeart Women's Sports.
Ever wonder what it would be like to be mentored by today's top business leaders? My podcast, This Is Working, can help with that. Here's some advice from Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, on standing out from the leadership crowd.
Develop your EQ. A lot of people have plenty of brains, but EQ is, do you trust me? Do I communicate well? Develop the team, develop the people, create a system of trust, and it works over time.
I'm Dan Roth, LinkedIn's editor-in-chief. On my podcast, This Is Working, leaders share strategies for success. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.